So, good evening. It's good to see you all. Almost I could just sit and listen to the crickets for an hour and let that be the talk. It'd be a good Zen talk. Did you get it?
Yes.
Yes, you got it. I see that you got it. Yeah. I'm going to speak a little bit about... You didn't get it yet?
No.
All right. They'll keep going. They just keep singing. Uh-huh. You get it. You get it. Yeah. Most days I don't get it either. That's why we're here. Yeah. So here's a little talk about intimacy. Something about what we're doing here. So there's this word mindfulness. I don't really like it as a word. It was the translation the British translators came up with for the term sati in Pali or smriti in Sanskrit. And the word literally means memory. It means remember, or remembering. You know, the translators read the texts, they were like, what does this word mean? And the descriptions were something like, you know, you should give rise to this quality called sati, memory, remembering. You should give rise to it in relation to the body, in relation to your feelings, in relation to your mind, and in relation to all of these qualities that pour through the mind all the time. Wholesome qualities, unwholesome qualities, the hindrances, the perfections, all of these phenomena that appear. So the translators saw this, and they practiced, and they puzzled about it, and they said, oh, I think this means pay attention. And in Britain, when you want to pay attention to something, you mind it, right? Like mind the children, or in the subway, you mind the gap, you know, or you mind something. So it's fine. It's a fine way to use the word, right? It means give your attention to it. Unfortunately, over here, we don't use the word that way. We use it to mean the thing upstairs that yaks and yaks and yaks at me all the time. Oh my God, my mind, my crazy mind. And so mindfulness turns out to maybe point me a little bit in the wrong direction. Add to this the fact that in the early traditions, there was no separate word for the place where emotions happen that we now call the heart. There was only one word, and it meant, you know, that sense that inside you, things erupt. And they're like feelings and thoughts and ideas and concepts and all that. All that has one word for it. The word is citta. Citta. So in some texts, in my lineage, one of the lineages I've studied in and been inspired by in the Thai forest Buddhist tradition, often the word is translated as heart rather than mind. So to even make the distinction, thoughts here, up in the head, feelings down here in the chest, doesn't really exist in early Buddhism and yoga, as far as we can tell. Different energies happen all over the body in different ways. So this word sati, it neither means do something with the mind, as that we might think with mindfulness. Maybe attention or paying attention is closer. But what if we go back to the original kind of literal meaning? Oh, it means remember. Remember. And then we get this instruction in the early texts. Remember the body. It literally says, be mindful of the body in the body. All sorts of scholars don't know really what this means. Different teachers teach it different ways. The body in the body, why does he repeat it? Why does the text repeat that? But what if we translate it rather than be mindful, what if we say remember? We go to the literal. Remember the body in the body. That feels a little different. What is it to have an instruction to remember your body? What happens when we remember something, right? Sometimes I think, oh, my memories, you know, all that stuff that happened, all of the time that happened before this moment, you know, like dinner, and then yesterday, you know, and then like going to the zoo when I was 10, and then like, you know, as far back as you go. My grand adventurous story. So those are memories for sure. But the sages that came up with this word were wily. They were subtle. What do they mean by remember? Because they don't mean remember the body of the past. They don't mean sit around thinking about, you know, how strong I was when I was 22. They had a different word for that called thinking, right? It's not the same as sati, remember, be mindful. So then what would they mean? Remember the body. So what happens when we remember? Like the very moment of remembering something, what happens? Something that's real, that we've experienced, appears in consciousness. Right? I remember my sweetheart who's up in Oakland crocheting little octopuses, finger puppets with curly little limbs. We saw them in this cute little, like, touristy shop in New York when we were back in New York last week, and she was like, they were in like a little sort of Etsy-type store, right? All the little handmade things. And we saw them, and we were like, oh, those are so cute. And I love her, she's great. She was like, I can make that. And so we got back, and she's been crocheting octopuses. Octopi. So I remember my sweetheart. What happens? An image, but also like a felt sense comes into my, we could say mind, but actually it's body, right? What happens? Oh, this feeling comes over me. And I recognize this feeling. It's called, you know, it's called like, oh, I'm in love with this woman. That's one way I could say it. Something happens. Oh, I remember her. And so if I look right at that moment, what's happening? There was a thought. The thought isn't the memory, right? A thought is a bit of information. The remembering is what happens when it appears in my experience. And we call it remembering partly because I notice it, right? We're thinking stuff all the time that we don't really notice. But sometimes, right, we're awake, we notice our thoughts or our feelings, we tune in, and we see how it, or we experience in the body how it appears in the moment. So here I am meditating, and I have the intention, I'm going to stay with my breath, feel a few breaths, very nice. And then I spend a little while going, yeah, I forget the breath, right? I forget. I was with it, and I forgot. That's all that happened. And I spend a little while doing something else, you know. Oh, I should write this thing in my dissertation. I should work on that. There's not very much time. Oh, I should stay up late. Oh, maybe I'll do this next week. Mind does that for a while. Thoughts come through. And then what happens? You can't do this willfully, right? Because as long as you're gone, you're gone. And then at some point, magically, out of nowhere, oh, I'm meditating. And the breath appears, and the body appears, and the thought of the thing I have to do kind of falls away. I didn't do that on purpose. If I could do it on purpose, I never would have gotten distracted in the first place, right? Because my teacher said, stay with the breath and don't do anything else. You know, and I like to be a good student. I try to do that. Why is it that with every intention to do that, I forget the breath, I do something else, and then suddenly I remember it again? That remembering, that moment when it appears in consciousness, that's a moment of mindfulness. And now I'm going to say it's a moment of intimacy, which is a word I like much better than mindfulness. It's much juicier. it appeals to my California sort of hippie spirit more than, you know, mind the breath, young man. Like, no, go away. But, you know, become intimate with your breathing life. Like, huh, okay, that sounds good. So here's the invitation. All we need to do is wake up. Waking up means remembering what's happening. In other words, tuning in to what's here. Remember the breath. Oh. Remember the body. Right? When I ask you in practice, notice what's pleasant, what's unpleasant. What I'm asking you to do is remember, to let the direct experience of pleasure or the direct experience of pain or discomfort register in the heart, register in the body, and be known, not just slip away, kind of unnoticed. When I remember things, I'm intimate with them. I generally remember things that have some charge to them. Right? If I think about last year, and you say, what happened last year? I would go, huh. You know, I'd scan through, and I'd come up with a little list of things that were kind of potent, right? I'm not going to say, well, there was this day that I had oatmeal. Yeah, there was this other day that I had polenta. Yeah. Right? That's not what would happen. Right? I would be like, oh, yeah. There was, you know, there was that period we were totally fighting and it was hard. Oh, I hated that. Oh, but then we had this amazing party. That was really beautiful. This person did this thing. Oh, my friends got married. Oh, that was such a beautiful day. And, you know, oh, that trip we took to such and such. In other words, I'm going to notice the highlights and the lowlights. I'm going to notice things that were actually strong enough to wake me up out of sleepwalking, out of the trance of ordinary life. So to remember is to connect with things that are kind of strong enough to connect with. So for me, intimacy means like come closer toward or give more energy to something. And of course I'm drawn to do that, to things that kind of show themselves to me. And in this way, and I'll talk about this a little bit, that it becomes a little bit reciprocal. It's not like I'm this isolated sort of camera witness in the world going around saying, I see that, I see that. It's more like I'm moving around through the world and I'm like, oh, redwood tree. And, you know, it's not one way. Like, what was the tree doing before I was there? I don't know. But in this moment, it shows itself. Something happens. We meet each other. And of course, we notice this most, I think, with other human beings because we're those kind of animals. You're with your friend, your lover, your child, your parent, someone that you connect with, or you're with your enemy, the person that you really don't like. But something happens between people, and you both wake up. Oh, you're here. This is what we're doing. Hello. You know. And that happens whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. We like it best when it's pleasant, for sure. So here's then something about this path. It's a path that describes a way to come into a deeper intimacy with ourselves, with our life, with the world. And the practice is the same as the goal. The practice is come into more intimacy. And the result is you will experience more intimacy. And freedom at the end is something like absolute intimacy, something like that. So here's a poem, or a little teaching verse, early Buddhist teaching verse. To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to awaken with the myriad things. Or we could retranslate the last line, to forget the self is to become intimate with all things. To study the way is to study the self. So the beginning of this practice, and the kind of the first thing I want to talk with you about, is study. I use the word inquiry a lot. This practice of yoga, meditation, awareness, cultivating awareness and energy, is at its heart a path of studying the self. Who are you? Or, in practice, I would actually just say, who am I? Or what am I? That's a practice unto itself. There are teachers in the world who will just say, just ask that question. Who am I? Who am I? Over and over. Until you're done asking, basically. Until it shows itself. But let's look a little bit. Here's some of what may have showed up for you in the last couple days as you study yourself. You may have noticed your body. And you may have noticed that what happens when you have a body is that you have pleasures and pains and numbness. Right? Sensations you like, sensations you don't like, and stuff you don't notice. And basically, that's what you get. You got a body, that's what you're going to get. You're going to get some collection of pleasures, pains, and neutral stuff. Everything else. Notice that what I'm not talking about with body is qualities that we might, you know, have a judgment about. Your body has a certain shape, you are the certain amount of strength you are, you're a certain age, you're a certain, all the particulars. That's not what we're talking about. Because you don't directly experience any of those things. Those are descriptions, you know. What we experience is sensations and feelings and their quality. The quality of pleasant or unpleasant. So like, in terms of people who have, you know, say, a strong body, I'm somewhere in the middle. Some things I'm pretty strong at, some things I'm kind of weak at, kind of in the middle. I sort of always take extra breaks in the core work and drop out a little before the end, right? That's where I am strength-wise. And that fluctuates. But that's a description. That's not actually what I experience. What I actually experience is, you know, the desire to do something and the ease of doing it when there's strength. The desire to do something and the difficulty of doing it when there's not enough strength. I experience a sensation that's painful, a sensation that's pleasurable, that vibrates. So, in the study of the self, the thing we focus on is, in the body, sensations and their qualities of pleasant or unpleasant. And everything else we kind of let go. What your pose looks like, we don't really care. I mean, we care, as long as you're not injuring yourself. But it actually doesn't matter how it looks. But how you're relating to being in it, that matters. So that's what we're orienting toward. So there's sensations. And then there's emotions, which you may have had a few of at some point recently. Right? I'm going to bracket emotions for a second and go on. And there's thoughts. So if I'm going to use this really basic three-part division, body, heart, mind, that we use. For body, lots of sensations. They're pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Thoughts, right? About anything. Past, future, myself, others, analysis, judgment, complaining, whatever. Thoughts are also pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. The reason I bracketed emotions is that they sit kind of right in between. What we call an emotion usually has a mental aspect, like a story that it's connected to, and a physical aspect, some energy or sensation. Like, you know, I might start thinking about politics and get angry, which happens. But what's actually happening when I'm angry? If I investigate, if I study, I'm going to notice something like well, there's thoughts about, you know, politician X that I dislike and how he said this really stupid thing. Rah, 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 rah. You know, and I'm grumpy about that. So that's all thought. And I can just notice those thoughts. It's a story, right? Here's this dude, I don't like him. And then there's a feeling, and the feeling is going to have some sensation in it. It's like, oh, my belly gets tight. I get a little hot when I get angry. I'm like, I'm starting to heat up, right? Like in the cartoons, you know, the head gets red and the steam comes out the ears because it feels like that. That's a description of sensation, emotion as sensation. So next time you have a big emotion, look for those two things and see if you can separate them. In other words, see if you can notice, okay, here's the story and here's the sensation. Right? I think about my girl, I have the lovey feeling, and I can identify, like, oh, here's the story about how, you know, like, I'm just so happy about what we're doing right now, and she's so pretty and smart, and I just want to hang out with her all the time. That's thoughts. But then I can tune into the feeling, and it's like, oh, it's that, like, kind of soft feeling in my body with a little bit of longing, like, I don't know why she's 50 miles away right now, right? Why? I don't know. I actually don't know, right? She's like 8 months pregnant and I'm far away. I'm like, why? It's terrible. I want her to be right here. So she almost came, but nesting was more important. So there's the thoughts and the feelings, the thoughts and sensations, and combined together we get these complex experiences we call emotions. So to study the ways to study the self, I say, okay, well, what am I then? So far, I'm sensations, thoughts, and the mashup of the two that I call emotions. And all that stuff is constantly bubbling all the time, right? Aspects of all three of them are there all the time. Part of what we do when we remember or practice being aware is we just notice which one is foreground. What's happening right now? Oh, I'm aware of speaking. I can aware of a thought stream is happening. There's sensations happening, including hearing. There's some feeling happening. There's this light sort of wash of like hoping that I'm saying something useful. Right? That's a little emotion, right? There's a little joy present because I really love the Dharma. I mean, I just love my job, basically. So I'm just happy. I can feel that. So, in some funny way, like, okay, well, that's what I am. Or at least, so far, that's what I can attend to. That's what I can notice. So now I'll keep going. Who am I? Well, there's sensations and feelings and thoughts. Now we'll go on, right? They're pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Every single experience, every phenomena in that list is going to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. There's no way for it to be other than that. That's what we get. Everything has a little charge. Given that, this is what I talked about this afternoon in the practice, we can either recognize that that's just how it is, right? That's just the nature of things. There's the sound of crickets, and it's pleasant. There's the temperature of the room, and for me at this moment, it's very slightly unpleasant. The teeniest bit. And so that's just reality, right? That's what's happening. I could say, oh, I'm aware of that in this moment. Now what? If I have the habit that unless we've practiced very deeply, we probably have, I have been experiencing things that are pleasant and unpleasant for so long that there have sort of solidified in me a set of reactions to them, right? I hear the pleasant thing, I want more. I experience the unpleasant thing, I want less. All the stuff I'm not noticing, I'm spaced out to, right? What this means is that if I'm not cultivating a quality of being intimate with what's happening, it is very likely that I'm going through my life reacting moment by moment to what's happening in an unconscious way, which means I'm being driven by an unquenchable thirst every moment. And that thirst is, how could I make this better? And it's always there. If we don't learn to interrupt it, it's always there. For most people. Which also means there's moments where it's so subtle that we can't feel it. Right? If those days when there's just the oatmeal and a little bit of work and everybody was nice but I didn't really notice it, the neutral days, right? When things are really neutral, there's also this subtle dissatisfaction. You know, some part of me is like, I'm bored. But if I don't notice even that, like, I can just sleepwalk through my life. And who wants that? Right? So, when there's not awareness, there is reactivity and fundamental dissatisfaction. The word for dissatisfaction is dukkha, and it literally refers to a badly cut hole in a wooden wagon wheel where the axle is bumping around it all the time, so the ride is really bumpy. Every little bump you hit, you feel it, right? No shocks on that wagon. This is the bumpiness of dissatisfaction, of dukkha, right? How many of our thoughts are springing from that place? Oh, you're nice. Maybe we could hang out more, right? I go from like sensation, pleasant, right into wanting. Oh, that tastes good. I want the recipe. Oh, I just felt a tiny prick on my ankle. Mosquitoes, I should go inside. Right? Do you really want to spend every minute of your life running? You say you don't, but it's very hard not to. Right? It's very, very hard not to. We're talking about a deep layer of our psyche. We're not actually talking about kind of our psychology, the stuff we like and dislike because of our family conditions and who loved us and who didn't and how we were abused or neglected or spoiled and now we're a bit of a jerk but we're trying to get over it. Like, all of that stuff, right? That's there too. The Dharma goes in under that. It's like, yes, all that's true. Please go to therapy and work on that. But there's more. And the there's more is very subtle. So, part two. Pain. You wouldn't be here studying the self if you hadn't been impelled here by something like pain. Whether subtle or gross, something in your life said, wait, more must be done about this. Right? Because the same old round of Froyo and Orange is the New Black, it's just not doing it. You know, it's pretty good, but it's not doing it. Pain brings us to practice. Almost all of us. And it brought me. I was so shut down, so miserable. I scraped my way through teenage years in a California suburb. I failed out of high school. I ran away from home because I didn't want to go on a family vacation to Canada. I spent an entire year with my Walkman on repeat, listening only to Depeche Mode, wearing a black trench coat, and skulking around the high school because everything was terrible, right? And then I dragged my way through art school, obsessing about operas where everyone dies in the end. And then I didn't know what to do as a young 23-year-old after after college, because what are you going to do after that? I had $35, but I had a decent backpack. I walked to the edge of my California suburb in the East Bay, and I hitchhiked to New York. And I was on the road for several months. And I got all sorts of rides, some I shouldn't have taken. I never got badly hurt, but, you know, I rode 50 miles across the prairies of Colorado and western Nebraska with two neo-Nazis on speed, like swastika on the chest, no pupils. I was like, what am I doing here? I was really suffering. I was looking for something. I didn't know where to go to find it. It wasn't in Livermore. It still isn't, really. I mean, but it turned out it wasn't in LA or Santa Fe or Boulder or Lincoln or Des Moines. Des Moines was sweet. Or Minneapolis or Thunder Bay or Toronto or Buffalo, although Niagara Falls is amazing. Or in New York City, where I met up with a girl who was great, but it wasn't there either. I was really fortunate that my sort of mostly out of fuel glider wandered around the country and kind of crash landed at a monastery. So there's pain. And because we're animals, we're these organic creatures, we respond to pain in some very organic ways. And again, I'm not going to talk so much about like the psychological kind of level of like projection and how we sort of maneuver in relationships. I want to talk kind of about our direct or intimate relationship with pain. And I'm going to talk about it through a little lens that brings in some nervous system theory or information. To keep it pretty simple, and some of you will have heard this kind of thing before, although you may have forgotten it, you are a mammal. You're an animal. And you're an animal that is one of many animals. And you are descended from animals who lived outdoors all the time, in forests and grasslands and jungles, where there were other animals, some friendly, some unfriendly. And you have the nervous system of the complex mammals. So, you basically do four things in relation to kind of your animal nature. And we can say you do these four things when there is something like a threat in the environment. So here you are, you're cruising along, you're doing whatever, and something happens and you're alert. Right, you hear a crackling in the brush. Right, you hear a car door around a dark corner, and you stop. So this is still us, right? It doesn't matter if it's forest or my neighborhood in Oakland, right? That startle reflex is exactly the same. So, we have a basic mode that we're in. When we feel safe. When we feel safe and not threatened, we have a mode that we can call social orientation. We're tribal animals. We're not like lone cats stalking the woods. Although I thought that was my spirit animal for a long time. I was like, I'm a solitary predator. But I was not actually. I was just a depressed teenager. I confused the two. Not hard to do. We're actually not like that. Even introverts we're tribe or group or clan oriented. So the first level of our nervous system, the most advanced level, is social orientation. This is how we know that we're safe, by checking out the faces of the people around us. Right? We read subtle distinctions in facial expression very quickly, before even thinking about it. You meet someone and you know if they're safe or not, instantly. Right? You didn't have to figure it out. Sometimes it's a little confusing, but some part of you knew. Right? And at the same time, you meet someone and you instantly, without ever knowing anything about them, you just feel good. You just want to be near them. You feel safe in their presence. Right? We can read that instantly. You read energy. Right? You just come across someone, you're like, oh, you're like my friend. One of my teachers describes meeting a Tibetan teacher whose title is the Karmapa. He's the head of one of the lineages of Tibetan Buddhism. He's kind of a parallel to the Dalai Lama. He was a little older. The current one is about 20 or 25 years old now. So 26 years old, this one that I'm going to talk about died, and this is his reincarnation now. Let's not get into that. But there you go. The previous Karmapa was this like chubby old Tibetan guy, fairly powerful, they say. And my teacher says he was super skeptical about lamas and magical powers and all that stuff. And he was like, yeah, whatever. But he was part of this group of people that was going to pick this guy up at the Boston airport. So they go to pick him up, and all the attendants are fawning over him and doing all this stuff. And my teacher's like, eh, it's just another fat monk. I've met a lot of fat monks. Yeah. But he was, you know, sort of helping him with things and doing things. And, you know, but he was happy to be doing it. It was like, fine, you know, it's just an offering to the Dharma. He was cruising along. And then at some point, he kind of walked away from the group a little bit to go and, like, get a drink or something. And he said he walked about 15 feet away, and he just got this chill. It was like there was a field of warmth around this person. And he could just feel it. He was like, oh. And he said it just sort of, it kind of felt like the spark drained away. Right? And he just wanted to go back in and be close again. So social orientation, it's how we know we're safe. And it's our kind of most advanced way also of dealing with threat. Someone seems unsafe, you know, you kind of talk your way out of it. Gotta go. Right? A step down into our animal nervous system, we have the sympathetic nervous system, which is the system that activates fight and flight. Something is threatening, and you have the instinct to either engage or fight or flee. Primal instinct, it's going to happen below the level of thought. You know what that's like. You walk into a room, and some part of you is like, eh-eh, and you just leave, right? So that level, fight and flight, the emotions connected with those are anger and fear. Anger, in some ways, even low-level anger, which we could call like frustration or annoyance, is we could say some way my system is saying, nope, don't like it, you know? That's threatening my well-being. You know, even if it's a stupid threat, right? Even if it's just like, tempeh. Retreat centers always serve tempeh. It makes me fart. Why do they do this? It's not 1975 anymore. Why wouldn't they figure it out? I'm so grumpy. You know, right? I'm annoyed at this step. And it's not actually true about today, right? I actually loved it, but whatever. I can be annoyed about something, you know. It's like, oh, left the toilet seat up. Right? I'm not actually under threat, but actually the response is the same. It's just like, no, get this experience away from me. And you can see how that response is very much what we're talking about when we're talking about aversion. I want something to stop happening. We can say that tendency, resisting what's happening, arises out of this basic defense system. I feel under threat and I want it to stop. the flip side of that, fear, or its mild cousins of worry, its mild cousin worry, right, is like, oh no, get me away. I gotta get out of here. It's also a response to threat. Worry is a response to threat. Worry says, oh, something bad's going to happen. I better get out of this. Right? It's also, you know, a response to like, oh, something's happening and I want it to stop. Right? I want to get away from it. So fight and flight are responses to fear when our system turns on. And it lights up the musculature. We're ready to run. We're ready to go. Things get hot. The last of the systems, so we have social orientation, fight and flight, the sympathetic activation. The last of them is freeze. This is the oldest system. This is the system that's available to the very, very kind of simple animals, like bugs and reptiles. Some of the mammals still do this, like possums, right? And freeze happens when escape is impossible. Freeze happens when there's threat and I can't get away. So at its most severe, the whole body shuts down and just like plays dead. Right? Most of us, God willing, are not in that kind of threat in this life. And I pray that you never will be. If you have been in the past, I pray that you never will be again. Be in that kind of life threat. But we live in a wild, disembodied culture that actually is giving us signals of a certain kind of threat all the time that we can't get away from. Like how expensive it is to live in the Bay Area. There's no, unless you want to move to Des Moines, there is no escape. And the prices are going up in Des Moines too. Right? Or deeper, like, you know, the feeling of like, it's hard to make it. It's hard to connect with people. Loneliness is hard. You know, having to constantly struggle is hard. There's a certain kind of inescapable threat that happens just in our ordinary modern life when we get overwhelmed. Things are just too much. There's just too much. I cannot track the war in Syria and the war in Afghanistan and the war in and the war in and the war in and the war in and my relationship and what's happening in local politics and what's happening here, what's happening there. And it's like, over threshold. I can't do it. And what's my response? I can't fight back against that. How am I going to fight against the feeling that there's too many wars going on? And where am I going to flee to? I tried monastery. They were all still going on. So freeze is the defense of last resort. And it's connected to numbness, and it's connected to that quality of delusion or spacing out. This is what happens when what's happening is too intense for me to deal with. And the mild version of it that I would guess we all have some experience with is just that little shutdown. Just like, I can't deal with this anymore. You don't even think the words. I'm just kind of glazing over. Right? I'm having a conversation. It turns toward charged material. I'm even trying to stay with it, but I just hit a little edge and I'm like, oh, I can't feel anymore. I just kind of wash out. I'm fortunate to have a really perceptive sweetheart. The instant that happens, she's like, oh, baby, where'd you go? And I used to get all defensive, but now I don't. And I'm like, oh, I fell off the edge. We said two things too many, and I couldn't do it anymore. I had a super hard day one day. It was like work was piled up and there was complex stuff happening in different ways. And it had just been like so busy. And I got home after the end of a whole bunch of things. And it was all like, ugh. And I just laid down, and we had been talking about some intense stuff, and I was just like, I just need a breather. So I was resting, but still kind of spinning. And my sweetheart came in, and she was like, what do you want for dinner? And the sense that I had to now make a choice, I just started crying. I was like, I'm beyond, like, just, I don't care, you know, like, it wasn't even that, that's too fiery, it was just like, pew. And she was great, she saw it, she was like, oh, oops, I kicked you off the cliff, and I was like, you didn't mean to, and she's like, I'm gonna make some dinner, you just lie here. So, I know. So, what do we do with this? This is the situation. What do we do? The practice here says, here's what to do. First of all, it says that healing in relation to this system where these emotions and these experiences are constantly happening and changing, healing is restoring rhythmicity. This is a phrase that one of my teachers uses. Healing is restoring rhythmicity. And we can think about this way. All this stuff is happening, pleasant, unpleasant, sensations, thoughts, feelings. What's really happening when we get stuck in something? When we're having like a doubt storm or an anger storm or a fear storm, or we're in something with somebody or ourselves and we can't get out. We're spinning in that one thing. What's happening is that the constant flow of stuff, experiences, thoughts, feelings, sensations, pleasant, unpleasant, it's still happening, but a particular negative sensation or thought or feeling, mostly feeling, I've stuck to it. Like, rather than things continue flying through, it kind of has like rooted itself in my heart. And now I'm ignoring everything else that goes by, and I'm stuck to this one thing. Right? And your friend says, but look, bluebirds. And you're like, I don't care, I'm so miserable. And your friend's like, I brought you some chocolate. And you're like, I don't want it, I just want it. And, you know, it's kind of like, say, like, I will not let go of my painful thing.
But the chocolate, Sean, the chocolate.
It's chocolate, I know. And the chocolate nowadays is really good.
Yeah, still?
Still.
Okay.
No, sometimes it works for me. You know. sea salt. Super dark. You know, I'm like, I'll come out of my funk for that. I wish it worked long term. So, healing.
Try alcohol.
Ooh. Well, of course, this is actually why all of those substances are so powerful. They work very well for a few minutes. Unfortunately, both of those things. It's unfortunate that they work so well, but it's particularly unfortunate they only work for a few minutes, because you're really screwed if you fall into that being the only way. Right? So, rhythmicity is actually being intimate with things as they change. Rhythmicity is that the natural response of the organic body, the nervous system, your animal nature, is to be alert when there's a threat and to drop it when there's not. Right? When you feel safe, to open up, and when you close, to close. When there's a strong feeling, to process it, and when it passes, it passes. Right? This is a kind of a description of the awakened heart, or of freedom. Freedom, I'm sorry to say, doesn't mean the mosquitoes will go away. It doesn't mean that the heart won't get broken, or that you won't get old and sick and die, and that the people you love won't get old and sick and die. That's nature. That's the ecosystem. What freedom is actually that you learn how to be intimate with things as they change. And not get so stuck. To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. What happens when I don't get so stuck? When a strong feeling comes, and I'm with it, the way we've been practicing, I notice it. Oh, this is anger. This is fear. It's what's here right now. I'm not in denial about it. This is fear. And I feel it. Oh, it's unpleasant. It's actually, it's just that little feeling of wanting to pull away. Oh, it's just that. It's all it is. Wow, I just want to pull away. Sweet one, you want to pull away. It's painful right now, or I'm scared. Such a tenderness is here. Okay, I want to pull away. There's nothing actually wrong here. Nothing's going wrong. This is your animal nature expressing itself in relation to a painful moment. Stress hormones in the nervous system take about 30 seconds to dissolve. If you don't re-trigger the emotion with another thought about the story, it will change in under a minute, neurologically. But we don't do that, do we? We get scared, and then we re-scare ourselves. Right? What's going to happen on Monday? Ah! But what happens on Monday? Ah! But what if this thing happens on Monday? Ah! Right? That happens, that repetition, that habit happens because I'm not awake to it. I'm not remembering fear. To remember, to be intimate is, what's going to happen on Monday? Oh, I'm scared. Okay, I'm scared. Scared feels like this. Oh, look, it's already changing. Oh, you're nice. You know. It changes. It's going to change quite quickly, actually. To study the self is to forget the self. It partly means this quote that Pete's been bringing in from Byron Katie, who would you be without your story? Right? The story is, in some ways, that habitual re-triggering. Here's the transition we want to make. I'm a fearful person. That's a story. That's an identification. That's me taking a whole bunch of moments of fear from the past and stringing them together into an identity. I'm a fearful person. It's totally untrue. It's a good story. It's a good story because it makes me feel a little more secure because I think I understand who I am. That story is actually pleasant. Which is surprising, right? But it actually is because it's certainty. Well, I know what kind of person I am. I'm a fearful person. Right? I get a little hit of like security from that. But I start investigating, I start studying the self, and it turns out that my practice is actually to go, no, wait, this is fear happening in this moment. It has no connection to a different fear that happened last week, even if it seems to be about the same thing. And what about all those moments of non-fear in between those two islands of fear? I'm a fearful person. I could just as easily say, you know, I'm an ecstatic mystic because I've had a couple moments, you know. Neither one is more true than the other. Practice is to say, this is a moment of fear. Now this is a moment of curiosity. Now this is a moment of my hip aching. And this is a moment of noticing what time it is. And this is a moment of seeing your eyes. And this is a moment of seeing the light shimmering off the gold Buddhas. And this is a moment of feeling the breath. To study the self is to forget the self. It turns out that who am I wasn't really the right question. There's just this play of light, sound. The early sages called it a magical show. Like flowers in the sky, they said. Don't even try to pick them. Right? This body, your beauty, your youth, all of your ideas, your smartness, the things you like, the things you don't like, all of those friendships, all of your loverships, your family. Flowers in the sky. Right? They're these beautiful sort of light shows that appear, and we live into them, intimate with them. This story is not trying to tell you that nothing matters. It actually tells you exactly the opposite. It says that it's impossible to say that anything matters more than anything else. To forget the self is to awaken with all things. There's no difference between breath, crickets, heartbreak. There's totally a difference between breath, crickets, and heartbreak. Right? As I'm intimate with them, and I just feel them, here's a moment of crickets. I'll end with a poem. I've been reading Jane Hirschfield poems. I read one earlier today. Here's another one. Three times my life has opened. Once into darkness and rain. Once into what the body carries at all times within it and starts to remember. Each time it enters the act of love. Once to the fire that holds all. These three were not different. You will recognize what I am saying, or you will not. But outside my window, all day, a maple has stepped from her leaves like a woman in love with winter, dropping the colored silks. Neither are we different in what we know. There is a door. It opens, then it is closed. But a slip of light stays, like a scrap of unreadable paper left on the floor, or the one red leaf the snow releases in March. Just let your eyes close for a moment. Just noticing. What's here now? the body with its swirling pleasures and pains. The heart with its swirling pleasures and pains. The thinking mind with its swirl of pleasures and pains. To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become intimate with all things. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. So let's see.